Hi, welcome back to Black Healing Remix, the space where we remix discussions on wellness, healing, liberation, decolonization, and much, much more. Today, I am joined by Dr. Evan Auguste. He is a brilliant mind, also a great colleague, who's been doing work at the intersection of forensic psychology, decolonization, liberation psychology, and much more for years. In our conversation today, we dive into ancestral memory. We dive into the work that he's doing in Haiti. We dive into what does it mean to do Black work as a forensic psychologist? How do we actually cultivate liberation? It's a very layered discussion that goes into masculinity and much more. Can't wait for you to check it out and let us know what you think. Welcome, everybody. I have to say that I am super excited, thrilled, and honored to be in conversation with a colleague who I have just the utmost respect for, who's someone I feel like is really carrying the lineage of sacred healing work for our people across the diaspora. And he is someone who we've had many conversations like that of where have been giving me much life, giving me much joy. And so I'm just really excited to welcome Dr. Evan Auguste for a conversation today on healing, the racism, Black communities, African communities, Haitian communities, all these nuances. We about to get into it because he's a brilliant and beautiful light. And so welcome, Evan. How you doing today? How you doing?
Now I'm feeling good. Now I'm feeling great because sometimes you do this work so often, having somebody say that to you, that feels good. That's who I've wanted to be. So to see you saying that feels good. How I'm doing is a bigger question. I think I'm feeling the weight of this political moment. I think I'm watching it really tear at a lot of the people that I love. I'm watching them try to adjust, shift, relearn safety. So that's tough. I'm sitting with that because that's inherent to the work that we both do, how to show up with that day by day. And there's the anchoring and the fact that people have not been in this particular moment, but people have been in similar moments before, carried each other through, held each other through. And so I'm trying to find my pockets of warmth amidst everything else going on. So that's where I'm at right now.
I appreciate you sharing that. And that resonates with me as well. I feel also this heavy grief, you know, and it feels global. Like, you know, it feels diasporic, but also goes beyond the Black and African diaspora. It feels like this grief this is where we're at. Seriously, mm-hmm. You know, with all the wisdom and insight that we know, how could this be allowed to happen?
That's
And I'm carrying that grief for the veneer, because it has been a veneer that is no longer out there. We now are much more, some of us who were not aware of that veneer are now much more clear about where we are at and what context we live in. But I'm also holding and feeling kind of like this polarization, not polarization, maybe it is. It's like a push-pull of this like ancestral power, recognition, you know, lineage. It feels like all that's really feels like it's kind of like coming in through me in a different way, even as I'm holding this grief for what this moment means for our folks and what it means for the future. And so it's very nuanced because I don't want to be in that place where I'm like psychologically like, you know, gaslighting people. Yeah, sis is going to be like, girl, hold on now. Hold on, sis. Like, it's too much. Like, and also want to hold that we do have power and also hold that like these systems have power too. And we're in that context, you know? So I feel like I'm holding both of those things while trying to do healing work like you're doing healing work and seeing beauty in it and also seeing a lot of sadness.
I think you named it perfectly. And I was talking with somebody, I can't remember the specific person. I think it was my colleague in Kemko and Yewo, right? what you named, right, there's a degree to which we're existing in a moment where people, for the longest time, right, have ignored ancestors, right, intentionally. What that means, the wisdom of that. And at times you get the opposite, the romanticization of that.
We have
ancestors, that means everything is going to be okay. Well, no, listen, we got ancestors that lost. We got ancestors that failed, right? All of that is also true. And so I think that's what invites, nonetheless, precarity into it, right? Because we still have to fight for this particular moment. And there is no guarantee that we will win, but we have no other option than to try, is what it is.
Absolutely. And when we get to that realism, I'm always in community spaces. Somebody's like, call all the ancestors down and stuff, but hold on, exactly who?
Exactly.
That's like, like, I don't know if I want Uncle Mookie to come. I don't really know what he got to offer right now. You know what I mean? Like, I think this kind of like blanket that everyone who transitions into that realm is inherently gaining some great wisdom. And for me, and I think for many of my colleagues and friends who do ancestral work, we know that ain't true. We know that sometimes they come and be like, I'm not finna do that, Grandma, but I appreciate that offering. Okay. But that may not be the direction. Understanding that there are benevolent ancestors, people who have wisdom and things to give us. But I think that like sometimes there's an assumption that a transition means that wisdom is somehow elevated on a different level, as opposed to it being still some of the embodied wisdom that they carry throughout this lifetime. They're still valuable and helpful and insightful, but it doesn't mean that like all of your ancestors got a word. Because like, as somebody, doing a lot of work around my lineage, there's a lot of amazing like indigenous folks in my lineage, right? But also there's some white folks in my lineage, right? There's some people who are a little bit more hostile towards other parts of my lineage. How do we talk about that, particularly as African Americans who have that complex ancestral history, right? Yeah. It's not just like, I've had those experiences where, I go get like, Akashic Records readings, or I have spiritual experiences and I'm like, oh, I'm expecting like this ancestral moment in my meditation to come up. It's gonna be a big, tall African man. It's like, so that's clearly an indigenous person who's like, it's very short. You got to challenge some of your essentialist blackness stuff here, buddy, because you got a much more complex heritage. But that doesn't get held very well in our spaces,
That's exactly it. Like, there's two things I'm thinking. One is there's this deep understanding and I think yearning for ancestral power and guidance, but this idea that it somehow renders what we have to do somehow less complex, right? That these relationships that we talk about this all the time psychologically, interpersonally. Again, you do a lot of healing work, so people know how deeply complex working through pain and harm and contradiction and hope and love are with people that you can see eye to eye. Why do you think that would be any way less complex? When we start talking about spirit work, when we start talking about ancestor work, what made you think that would be any more unidirectional?
Yes, come on now, say it. That
makes no type of sense, which threads us to the other point. This is why I love the Amos Wilson quote. I don't have it all off the top of my head, but he talks about the real African-centered scholar takes what he knows from tradition and creatively applies it to this moment to liberate people. That's what it means to be in African-centered tradition. It's not about blindly moving through and supporting anything that you don't deeply understand. It's about consistent critical analysis and relationship to that. So all these pieces mean like, no, this doesn't render anything more simple or more shallow. It invites a whole range of opportunity. But again, that's also the opportunity for hurt, for pain, for betrayal, right? It just means that we have a full range of things at our play as soon as we begin to invite all those other possibilities in.
Absolutely. And I think the invitation of that nuance and that applied kind of framework, to me, is the distinguishing factor between how someone's doing their ancestral work and their engagement with their work, right? Like, like all those questions and those nuances coming into the space, or is it just this blanket, all the ancestors and blah, 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 and the spiritual world is always right. It's like, well, this is a much more complicated mechanism that we're engaging in my experience, right? I mean, and I think what's also really complicated, like, as someone who has, it's not unusual. Like, all of us have a very complicated lineages. But I think that when I started really accepting that, like, how do I ancestrally contend with that? Like, in a way that isn't the ways in which, you know, Black people in the South be like, I got Indian in my blood. Okay, girl, well, that's not the, and using it sometimes as a way to deflect away from Blackness, right? And from Africanity, right? Or using their like history of, I had a white person in my family to use, do the same thing to kind of establish subtly or not so subtly that like, I'm not like the rest of y'all niggas. Like that's what the comment is, right? Like, that's what it basically is. Like, so how do we own these complex lineages and own it without doing that, without serving anti-Blackness? How do we own the like deep enmeshment that Indigenous American communities and African American communities have with each other, from Maroon communities to the moment we were forcibly brought here? How do we name all that legacy and how that's in our spirits, in our genetic memory, without using it as a tool to deflect away from Africanity or Blackness? You know, like that's the piece that I'm kind of like grappling with in some spaces where I see people say those things. I'm like, I'm having a hard time with how your juxtaposition of your ancestry and how it's being used. You know,
that's exactly it. And like the simplest way I think about this is with intention, right? Because you're right; these things are irreducibly complex. And so what that means is, no, like, ancestor work isn't something that you get. And now this thing makes sense.
Come on now. Come on.
We're talking about a lifetime of practice. And I want to be super clear. So everybody watching this, I think, again, I want to be real clear. YOLO, my superhero. So that's why I'm here. YOLO, my superhero. So YOLO, the journey that YOLO's going on, I'm still, I would say, a few steps. I'm trying to get to where you're at. And we're trying to both go farther, right? There's a lot of work that I've even been doing recently where I lost my grandmother on my maternal side. We called her moms 2 years ago. And even recently, consulting with a few people, building an altar, honoring like them, their histories, learning more stories so I could have those as central as I'm honoring what she gifted me. And I had a moment where I was sitting there one day, I was thinking like, the woman that I knew wouldn't want anything to do with this right here. She wouldn't want anything to do with this altar that I placed. That goes for my other grandmother too. Both of them wanted nothing to do with that. So what does it mean to nonetheless be intentional about honoring who I knew them to be while they were here, while at the same time really taking seriously that, yeah, they experienced specific, particular forms of, I don't even want to call it, we could call it miseducation around their ancestral conditions that led, so they had such a negative relationship. My father tells a story about in Haiti, my grandfather didn't practice Vodou, but he was a fan. He understood it to be an essential part of Haitian culture. And so he would have all of these, what he would call like artifacts to honor that all around the house. My father says one day, my grandmother went in the room, the office, looked at all of it, took it while he wasn't there and threw it all out. Like, we don't want anything to do with this. Right? Because of her the education. She grew up, she went to those Catholic schools. Like that was how she understood to be good in the world. And so when we talk about intention, consistent grappling with what does that mean to honor somebody the way that I believe that we can honor somebody, the way that we've honored somebody for millennia, and the person I want to honor for damn sure wanted nothing to do with any of this. Consistent prediction.
Oh yeah, no, you're right. It's interesting. Because as you were talking, and I'll share this, like, yes, it is the contradiction. And it's also the nuance of what I want to say is, as someone who also comes from communities where altar building in that framework is foreign and not seen as something to be celebrated and uplifted, but I also come from the same community that builds altars when people pass in public spaces, that has altars in their homes that like, that they won't call an altar. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like they don't use that language, but when I go, I'm like, oh, this is a whole bunch of pictures of my grandma with all her artifacts. Okay, this is an altar, but you don't see this as an altar. Or whenever we're in any community, Black community across the world, when someone transitions and you see a public space where that person may have transitioned or been harmed, there's an altar up there. Now, would all people use that language? No.
That's it.
And it's really interesting when you, I mean, the same thing with my grandmother's church. Like, my grandmother is a Southern Baptist. I remember going to that church, and I'd be like, this is the most African shit I've ever seen in my
life. Exactly, right?
You know, and, but they would not, she would not make those connections. And actually have some internalized ideas that were really deeply anti-Black around it, right? That I'd be like, oh, no, wait. And so sometimes the practice of what's happening, what's in our bodies, what's in our practice is different from the ideological kind of defensiveness that we built around them, you know what I mean? Which is a really precarious and awkward place. Because I hear you, like, you know, how do you honor their legacy and know that they wouldn't want anything to do with these kind of traditions, hypothetically, in this framework, but maybe in a different framework, they might recognize it, you know?
Exactly. I love the point that you made. This is one of Naim Akbar's speeches, where he says, like, white people have you thinking that you can't do ancestor worship, that you can't do ancestor veneration. He said, look at Mount Rushmore. That's ancestor worship. You look at what they name all these schools and all these streets. That's ancestor worship.
So
put it right in your face and telling you that you can't do the same.
Come on.
An intentional ancestral way. So I think, no, that's a brilliant point that you're making. Because the one piece I want to say, and this is what I try to do in my work also, is when we're more intentional about that ancestor worship, when we dig into who these people were and the energy they tried to deliver, that's when we discover so many more political strategies. I was talking with a student of mine a few months ago. I was talking to him about, like, African-centered psychology, and he said, I'm interested in this to the degree that it can help me politically in this moment. And I thought that was fascinating because it's true. There's a lot of people who engage in spirit work at times to bring them further away, to mystify what they're experiencing, right? To bring them somehow away from face-to-face with their political condition. I think Fanon even talks about that at times. Like, religion helps people erase their tangible, material political position. But when you dig into the legacies that we're talking about, it's the exact opposite. For a lot of people, it's the exact opposite, right? And so, in the healing work that I've been engaged in, looking at the legacies of Thomas Hilliard, of Louis Mars, of people like this who were so intentional about how do we liberate people, how do we heal people, how we shape systems around this. Again, that's a level of ancestral worship that directly connects to how we get free and how we hold each other in these moments. So when we're intentional about the ancestral worship, that's a piece, right? It gives us new strategies and new possibilities for meeting this moment. Mm-hmm.
It speaks to what the, I'm going to say the white girls is not correct, but the people call the spiritual bypassing, right? Like, that's the language they've used, right? When you use the spirituality to evade the reality of what's happening in your current political moment. And then, like, you know, when I think about the practices that I've inherited, the practices I'm still growing and learning in, they're all about engagement with the political moment, right? And, like, strategies, you know, like, and so, 100,000% with you on that piece. Something else you said that really resonated with me, about the ancestral piece that I wanted to drop in. So like one thing that kind of connects to me with that story about your grandmother, my grandmother gave me a Bible that is, that I own. I'm not a Christian. And I think Jesus is amazing, but that's not my path, right? And I remember during the fire challenges we were having here in the city, I was potentially going to have to evacuate. And I started looking at your home about what am I going to take? And I have my whole altar, right? But the thing that I keep on that altar that connects to my grandmother is that Bible, which is the ways in which I link to her. And even though it's still on my altar, which she may not be, she might have been like, what is going on this? Right? You know what I mean? It's one way that I respect and honor what she held as a framework, even as I hold it within the context of my own.
I loved it. I was talking with him yesterday, who another person you would love. His name is Naya Toussaint. He's down in Florida getting his PhD, who did a lot of really great programming when he was over at the Union Seminary Church, or the Union Theological Seminary, rather. And they did a lot of work of connecting what they called their series. It was Decolonizing Christianity, I believe. And they spoke to the ways that when we look at, again, specific ancestors, that this plurality is also a part of that legacy. That people were able to hold so many different modes of practice and spirit and understanding and knowing together, right? That brought them closer, that helped them, again, plan, scheme, dream, shape space, right? And the moment, again, people started to get, Lyndon James Myers talked about a lack of diurnal thinking, right? Became too black and white in how they thought, saw things. It immediately reduced the amount of complexity in ways that people understood that they could be. Again, think about the Haitian Revolution. I think that's a great example. You have a revolution that starts with a Vodou ceremony by Boukman Dati, who people talk about the book. Some people say he's talking about the Quran. So already we're talking about distinct modes of practice involved in one of the biggest revolutions that everybody loves to name and honor. We're doing a project on intergenerational trauma, and one of the pieces that people name is the incomplete consciousness, that people weren't fully able to lean all the way into the precepts of the revolution, that multiplicity and plurality that shaped their desire for freedom, and immediately tried to reproduce the French Republic in Haiti. So you had these visions of the Lacroix, right? Not just as an idea, but a political superstructure for how we exist together, the way we practice, the way we see each other, and how that immediately comes into conflict with these ideas of we want to be like France, but we want to make it black, right? Which leads to a lot of those same colonial reproductions and relationships that end up being harmful. So again, it extends back when you remove the possibility of understanding the fullness of what our ancestors have been and honor the complexity, the I'm calling contradictions, you're saying both, and I love both of these things, right? It reduces the way that we can exist in the world, right?
You know, I think about that in relationship to so much things, just to like the ways in which it's an undercomplication of even self, right? The ways in which we understand and able ourselves, as well as like, you know, how we're able to engage the world. I'm thinking about gender. I'm thinking about I'm thinking about sexuality. I'm thinking about all these things that like these binary concepts we have, which really limit and restrict us, right? One of the ways I think about this, what you've raised up, is that sometimes when I'm holding space with Black men, I often hear men say, as a man, I can't.
Yeah.
For me, I'm always curious about that framing, because I see how this gendered concept, because what I'm hearing when someone says that is saying, my gender concept will not allow me to, right? Like, you know what I mean? And it's like it becomes a defense mechanism, right? And it's often followed by, as a man, I can't cry.
Yeah.
So it's like my gendered concept tells me, holds me, help keeps me from leaning into crying, right? Like, you know what I mean? And like when I have to free frame like that, it's always interesting how men are like, well, that means that it's me in some levels. I was like, well, it's layered, right? You know? But I think about like, how these concepts can hold hostage our imagination and what's not help us see the full range of who we are and what's possible for our lives. And I think that like that's the real danger to me in the binaries of the world. It's like they're so polarized, and it's like, well, there's a whole spectrum of existence and spirit and presence and power that's here. How do we lean into that and accept the multiplicities of who we are? You know, I'm sorry, the Black man piece is really on top of my head because it's So we just did a Black Masculinity Reimagined Summit in LA. We had about 55 folks, Black men, straight men, gay men, trans men, whole spectrum of people there, right? And there were so many things that came up in conversations and that have come up in conversations in general with Black men that I'm always like, we have really internalized deeply racist ideas about who we are. Like, so for example, this wasn't at a BMR, but it's a story I've been really sitting with for a while. There was a brother, and I have his permission to tell the story. But he identified. I was talking to him and working with him through some stuff around his partner, his own wife, or the wife at the time, excuse me. And he was talking about how he was really kind of struggling because he couldn't sexually show up with her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, okay, so we're just kind of asking more questions. And then I get to this point where I'm like, you're really angry at her. You don't like her. You seem to be upset with her. Usually there's a lot of distrust. He's like, yeah, but I don't got no reason why I still should be able to get it up and you know, fuck. I'm like, wait, hold on. Mm-hmm. And so I started to realize, I was like, wait, there's this thing that many Black men have internalized, that despite the fact that your body and your spirit are saying no.
Exactly.
His trust was broken with this woman. And yet you still feel that, like, as a Black man, I'm still supposed to, regardless of whatever I'm feeling, whatever I know to be true, be able to be this kind of sexual being for her. Mm-hmm. And when I engaged him more, and I was like, why do you think that as a human being, when all your spirit and your energy is saying no, why would your body say yes? Mm-hmm. He was like, I guess I just thought that I should always be hard. And I was like, well, where'd you get that idea from?
Yes, sir.
Where'd that come from? You know what I mean? And this is a brother who's like, you know, fits, who's like tall, big, like, you know, he had that. And you see all the stuff that's been put on his spirit. Mm-hmm. And so I say that to think about all the ways in which for Black men, for Black women, for all of us, these ideas internalize, erase us from our humanity. Right, you know what I mean? Like, limit our understanding of, like, hold up, you're a human being here. Like, you're having an emotional experience. This is what this, you're not supposed to still perform our work, even, you know, like, of course, there's going to be consequences. And so I think about that a lot with those concepts you shared. It's just something that enrages me. And I can hold it in the context of patriarchy, but I feel really sometimes an immense amount of grief for how I see so many Black men and masculine folks suffering because of the paradigm that's holding so much of their spirit and their joy hostage.
Hello, I'm Donnie Frazier, Beam's Digital Content and Community Engagement Consultant. I'm thrilled to tell you about our program, Black Masculinity Reimagined. This community and skills-building initiative supports Black men and masculine folks in addressing mental health and community violence. We offer events both virtually and in person across the country where participants can learn new strategies for connection, coping, and self-care while working to dismantle patriarchy and support collective Black mental health. Learn more at beam.community.
You named it so beautifully, right? Is, and I see it in both ways because I understand it. There are so many people who, especially if we're talking about Black men in the context of the United States, right? We're talking about historic experiences of domination, erasure, even under a lens of hypervigilance, or seeking like purpose and trying to find purpose through provision, through protection, because these are the stories that they've heard that they want to honor. And because it's not wrong, like, people need protection, right? People need sexual gratification, right? People want safety. And so to form your identity around that, in a way, it makes sense. But when you allow other people to dictate what those virtues mean, now you're, right, removing the humanity of yourself from the conversation. And that's the other piece. When we start talking about all the different types of possibility, masculinity, people, on a level, people know this. Like, masculinity can look and has looked historically so distinct and different depending on the groups of people that we're talking about. We have had a millennia. Sometimes people think, like, there's a natural form of masculinity that just exists. Like, it is manifested in so many different and distinct ways in direct needs of the community. And so now we're in this space where people feel like they no longer have agency to even shape how they show up and relate to their bodies, they relate to their partners. Right. And I'll say this, like, a lot of this is also not their fault. Right. A lot of that comes from specific structural experiences of, again, erasure, of violence. And I think sometimes we miss that. And I know you know that. People will talk about, I don't understand why this person won't cry. Sometimes I think men fail to think about that in their own self-narrative. It's like, well, tell me about a time that you tried and what happened. Tell me about a time where you tried to talk about what was going on for you. Tell me about a time you tried to be sad or angry and what happened. Right. And it can be violent, right? It can be a violent reaction. It can be an intense experience of rejection.
Absolutely.
It can look like hospitalization. It can look like incarceration.
Absolutely.
And sometimes people don't get told that structure and narrative. And so just blame themselves and internalize that.
Yes. It goes back to what I often do when I hear people say, a lot of times brothers be like, I can't be vulnerable with my wife. So what I'll say is, like, I want to invite you to do a little cynostem activity with me. I'm a big cynostem. I have, they're all over social media, little prompts. I love a cynostem because it's always interesting. I was like, I want to invite you in a sentence to write that sentence down and replace I can't with I'm choosing to.
Okay.
because. And then he replaced it with, I'm choosing not to be vulnerable with my wife because. And the because took a minute. I was like, what's the because? Because when I was vulnerable before, I got hurt. I got disrespected. I got violent. So then we go into the trauma of what happens, because all this is policed through trauma and violence, right? And the nuance, the piece that we're not really able to hold really well in our community, I think, in this moment, is that the patriarchal violence against masculinity is held by a lot of cis women, right? And we're in this moment where we don't know, where a lot of people don't know how to express their pain and hurt and rage at their experiences with Black women in a way that isn't misogynistic and denigrating and hateful. And there's, and like, not understanding, like, how do you do that? And so you have all these Black men that we work with, and you see, like, there's wounds around mom, right? There's hurt. There's wounds around women who maybe they're in that vulnerable moment. I shared my feelings with you, and then you told me I was less than. You cut me down. You embodied the patriarchy for me, right? And then what ends up happening is that they have the privilege in the patriarchal context, right? So they use that in certain ways that replicate harm and misogynistic harm against Black women, as opposed to processing that pain, that wound, and making other generative choices, right? And so I think this is really one of the things that I really want for our communities is, you know, I feel like when this, we have communities where it's almost it's uncomfortable to be mad at mom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, but it's interesting to me because, Evan, and this is one piece I've really been sitting with lately, and it's actually been very scary, but also very real, something I've recognized. There's so much unconscious anger at mothers and Black mothers. And one way in which I've seen that play out in the last couple of weeks is seeing, you know, there are many times people will connect me to someone in distress, and I'll connect them with someone in their city. Sometimes it's Philadelphia, sometimes it's New York, and they'd be like, somebody reaches out to me and say, I need some help. And so a part of what Beam does is, like, they'll reach out to us, we'll reach out to who we trust in that city, and then we'll pay that person to kind of do support for that family or whatever's going on. But one of the things that consistently have seen over the last month or so is how so many Black men, even with a father's present, when they go into psychosis, when they go into that state of like really kind of emotional distress, that rage, anger is to attack mom first.
Mm-hmm.
Their mothers are being attacked. And I think that's one thing that I've been sitting with. I'm like, wait, because I'm thinking back on my like 20 plus years. I'm like, have I known an instance where even when the father was present and a young boy was exhibiting, you know, characteristics of life, I'm not going to give them a formal diagnosis, but characteristics might associate with psychosis, schizophrenia, spectrum, et cetera. And I'm like, but it's always at mom.
Yeah.
It's like, even when dad was present, dad ain't getting the smoke.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's, and so that's just one level of demonstration of how much pain and anger that I think that Black men are carrying towards Black women, that we don't have spaces enough to be like, how do we help you process this in a way that helps you understand the context of patriarchy, the context of misogyny, and validates your pain and say, that was unacceptable, what happened to you, and it does not justify violence towards Black women. And I think that no one I see is doing that very well.
That last piece is it. I teach Black psychology, and I watch my brilliant students work through that tension all the time. I watch the Black male students who are struggling through tension, specific to what you're saying. And unfortunately, the people who've given the broader media space a vocabulary are ones who've done so with misogynistic, misogynoir in mind, right? And so you see those words creep in. I'm like, oh no, you had this pain and you didn't know where to go, right? And sitting in a classroom where people tell you, like, your pain is your own fault. Because again, and we're naming this, there are so many Black women, there's so many Black girls. I see this in clinical spaces and healing circles and in the classroom who know, like, yeah, like they understand patriarchal violence to a T. They've experienced it. Like, they have very real reasons to have rage and are justified in that rage. And nonetheless, we're now in the dynamic where you want to be in community with this person. So how can we hold space for this person's very real rage and hurt that they are not responsible for?
Right.
To your point, that might have been done by mom. And we can understand mom. We can understand the pressures that come with that. We can understand how that structure got displaced into this baby boy, and nonetheless, it was displaced. And now that's their introduction to this. Right. One of the people, my colleague Jean Semelfour, out in Jersey, does so much good work on this specifically. And again, he named something similar to what you're saying, is people really lack the language to see across that divide because there's violence there, right? It's white supremacist patriarchal violence, and it's tapping people in distinct ways, and people can't see that. It gets mistranslated, and all of a sudden, now the hate and harm is further entrenched.
Right. No, and one of the reasons this can't, I feel like it's difficult people see, is because of the binary understandings of the world, right? Like, you know, we are still grappling with how do we hold it? Like, some of the most patriarchal people I've had experience with who've inherited that deep domination and that deep commitment to those frameworks have sometimes been cis women, have sometimes been queer women, right? And then holding that with the complexities of they also operate in a broader context and a historical context, right? And so, like, you know, you're absolutely right. I think that what I see a lot with so many, and it's not just with Black cis men, too. I see the same thing manifesting in other bodies and genders, too. I'm like, you know, I spend time with, like, Black trans masculine folks, and I'm like, this is the similar framework, like, replicated and reorganized, you know what I mean, around this gender concept. And so it's in my opinion, it's kind of almost like a defensive mechanism that is like now, like, you know, has multiple kind of ways it shows up. But yeah, I think that sacred work that has to happen is we have to cultivate more spaces in our communities for Black women, for Black men, people of all genders, to find space to voice their anger at mom or feminine or maternal figures, because in giving that space a voice that honors it, that does not encourage degradation and dehumanization and misogyny, because I think that that is so much of the undertone of not just Black, our Black culture, but also American culture, is that deep anger, that deep resentment, you know? And the deep resentment has many different layers, but we haven't held that well. And I think also holding, you know, better that, you know, being femme presenting does not prevent you from embodying patriarchal violence. And that's something I tell people all the time. Like, as a non-binary person, I'm like, you know, I don't wear a lot of, I'm not wearing extra makeup in ways that people might perceive me to be gender androgynous, right? But I have colleagues who do, or people I know who do. And people assume that because you look like that, that you ain't embodying some of the most same typical patriarchal patterns and behaviors. And that's not the case. You can be, you can got lipstick on and you still in the same power dynamics, homie. Like, you know what I mean? It's the same shit happening, you know?
Exactly. And it speaks to, I think, what I'm going back to is, like, intention. Mm-hmm. I think what I struggle with, and why I give y'all so much credit, is, right, people exist in a social media space and a popular media space that is giving them such a shallow language to see one another.
Mm-hmm.
There's a complete destruction of, for a lot of people, third spaces where they can be in community together. Mm-hmm. And we already know we're in the wake of a lot of Black political groups, organizations getting just decimated by state violence. And so the spaces and trusted organizations that can hold community in that type of way, I think people are in dire need of. I'm thinking about, I think it's John Mbiti who talks about one of the particular things about African religions and African spiritualities is how particular they are to specific spaces, right? You're learning how to honor, like, this water. I'm learning how to be in relationship with this land. Right? I'm thinking about these trees right here. I have names for these trees right here. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, I struggle with this even with my, the work I do more popularly is, do I want to give people a single language, or do we want to encourage people to find that language in community? Because it might be different if I'm having that conversation in Paterson, New Jersey. What does that violence look like? What's the language that you all need to articulate this, right? Versus I'm having this conversation in, right, Sugar Hill in New York, versus I'm in Bracy, Virginia, versus I'm in Gonaive in Haiti. The language is going to be different, and it has to be different because we're talking about specific, distinct experiences of harm. Right. I watched, and this is what I think about, because I've, this conversation plays out in my Black psychology course in particular every semester, and it's great because I can see, I've taught everybody the same language, the same lessons. I have about 30, 40 brilliant people really passionate about these issues. And I watch how the conversation takes a completely different route based on, again, the histories of harm that are in the room. Right.
Man.
And so this, again, this is why I give you all so much credit, giving people the tools to articulate that difference, to begin to have that conversation. Then what it looks like from that is going to be about those specific relationships.
Right. We're both doing that work. I mean, with your circles, our circles, which we bringing the circles to the forefront of the conversation around healing and wellness in this country and the diaspora is so important. But no, I appreciate you saying that. But I think it's collective work that we're doing, right? We're trying to give language and create space for us to heal on a deeper dimension than what the Western mental health industrial complex has encouraged us to do, right? This individualistic, you know, self-absorbed, decontextualized, you know, mental health that doesn't hold all these nuances. We are so many things, you know? I love to talk about the circles for a minute. Like, I know me and you are big advocates of them as practices. I'm curious to, like, you can share more folks about that and how that shows up in your work.
Of course. No, so, I mean, you named it, right? Psychology, and I know, again, this is the Beam podcast, so people are probably familiar intimately with that history. What I think people don't spend as much time with is, even if we dig into the literature, we dig into the psychological research, there's plenty of evidence that people are fairly good at holding space. Once you have space, right, there's a healing quality to that. And so giving people that opportunity is something that I think psychology in some ways has pushed people away from.
Come on. I know where you're going. I'm with you.
And I just want to make like two clear points. One, psychology right now, I'm not even talking about the history of racism that people are going to be deeply familiar with, is not able to meet our needs as a community, right? As Black people, the plurality of those experiences, there are simply not enough people who have that quote-unquote training, who have those degrees to meet the weight of historical and contemporary need that we have. That's where we're at. We have to be grounded in our reality, right? If it were cost-effective, we're not even talking about it not being affordable. If it were cost-effective, there are not enough Black people who do this work to meet that amount of need. So that's my first piece. I always get frustrated when people talk about stigma as leading to being the biggest issue among Black people as it pertains to mental health. We can't even meet the need. The second piece is, if we were able to meet the need, does the training reflect your needs? Right. The Association of Black Psychologists did an assessment, and it was some, I don't want to, I'll speak more broadly, but it was something about only 20 to 40%. So I'm giving a pretty broad range because I don't know the specific number offhand, have received training on how to work with Black people. So you're talking about already having a reduced capacity. And of the people who have capacity, very few people have the training needed to hold people in all the deep complexity that we're naming.
Wow.
Right. So couple that with the fact that it was Thomas Isso, is a quote that has been, I think, went viral, has talked about having spent some millions and billions of dollars on neuropsychiatric treatments for psychological disorders, and in his own estimation, as the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, said he did not make headway in reducing psychological distress. And he's referring to the broad population of white people. So that's the landscape of psychology and psychiatry that we're talking about.
No, I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead.
This is the second point. I'm on my soapbox now.
Oh, come on, bring it.
On my soapbox now. Now, when we shift it and we have histories and evidence of what we're talking about as circles practices, of people being in community, showing up for one another intentionally, right? There's documented evidence of that efficacy. In Haiti, this is some of the historical work I've done. Louis Mars reshaped the entirety of the mental health apparatus to be outpatient communal care involving teachers, social workers, parents, Vodou priests and priestesses to hold space for people in community. And it was highly effective until you had the introduction of U.S. pharmacology. So we have the evidence of how to meet the widespread need. And so this is where the circle practices come in, right? As opposed to trying to fix a bottleneck scenario for an industry that we know, again, the blatant history of it is it's been used for exploitation and harm and invisibilization. Right. Let's give people the tools and the skills so that, again, they can intimately shape their needs to create wellness. Right. A tradition that far predates modern psychology. Now, I say all of that in the context that I entered this work as a clinical psychologist, which is why I still look at that evidence. We still do our qualitative, our quantitative studies and show that, no, this can work. Right. So, which is, again, I love being the Heart Space Circles at the forefront of this work. It's been the greatest honor of my career to engage in the Sal Bona Healing Circles because we've shown, I think we've demonstrated that if you give community the tools that they need, they can show up for their own healing.
So much good in there, Evan. So many things that, like, you illuminated that are the truth that, like, I hold as well and I share. You know, I really appreciate you lifting up the, like, this piece around the mental health industrial complex and this approach that is very Western, right? There are psychological and mental health professionals who can handle that. You can handle that. Like, the disempowering of our capacity to hold wellness for ourselves and our people. Right. When the reality is, you know, whether we want to go to, you know, for African-Americans pre-transatlantic slave Africa, we want to go look also at the early 1700s, 1600s here. We had to cultivate practices to take care of ourselves. We have history. We have this robust history of medicinal practices, of healing practices. And so that have been largely communal, that have been integrated into our space. But then you have Western world that says that, like, only one person can hold that. Like, you know what I mean? Like not that we all have a role. And this is a big part of why I created Beam. I was like, we all need to be holding a part. Mm-hmm. And what happens with this Western framework is that, like, you give it up. You're like, oh, that's not me. That's y'all. Okay, you do that. Well, it's like, hold on. What does that look like? And so I think that, like, that's such a, it's such a communal, it's such an African perspective, right? Like, you know what I mean? As opposed to this kind of, like, Western model, which disempowers us and disconnects us as well. You know what I mean?
That's it. And I want to be so clear, like, going back to what I said before about the distinction between, right, we've over-pathologized these ways and modes of practice. And we also don't want to romanticize because there's a lot of people who are going to say, listen, no, I came from the village. They were beating that person. What are you talking about?
Come on. Come on.
We want to be really clear.
Yes.
These are practices that people nonetheless have to can learn, right? It's not things that we should expect people just to inhabit after generations of having been told they can't do it. And that's what a lot of people don't know. You look at the some of the torturous conditions of mental health facilities around Africa. A lot of people don't know those are the vestiges of colonial occupations. You could look at the hospitals in Uganda, you could look at the hospitals in Nigeria, and their origins start in colonial occupation. Like, they're mausoleums to that, right? In Haiti, the very first mental health hospital was a Marine barracks during the U.S. occupation. So in some ways, when you're thinking about what you understand to be how your people understand mental health is nonetheless a historical occurrence, right? Of people implanting a specific institution and telling you this is the best way.
Come on now. And then, like, what does it mean also? Like, so one, I want to just lift up how much I appreciate, we cannot romanticize practices. Like, right? We can't be like, oh, the indigenous, you know, the ancestors knew
everything
about healing and they got it right and perfect. Like, nah, them niggas was doing some shit that wasn't right either. They was fucking up too. Like, we got to be honest about the fact that, like, you know, the practices are rich, but, like, the practitioner matters. And like, you know, the practitioner matters, the context matters, that any tool in the hands of someone who isn't skilled with it can harm, right? Like, you know what I mean? And even in the hands of someone whose skill can still intentionally, unintentionally create harm, there's a lot more nuance. So I appreciate you naming that. Like, yes, we are owning, naming, uplifting traditions and practices. And yes, these practices also need to come with a set of guidelines and ethics and just have challenges and have nuances. Because I think that like, that's the piece too. Like, you know, there is a lot that Western medicine has given us that can be useful if it is redirected and reimagined, right? You know what I mean? In the hands of capitalism, in the hands of these institutions, absolutely not. It's dangerous. But some of that, if it was reimagined and re-transmuted, essentially, could be helpful, right? And there's a lot of the practices that we do that we know in certain hands are beautiful and powerful. In other hands, that is some toxic, dangerous shit. Right? Like, you know what I mean? And so I think I really appreciate you lifting up that, like, we have to hold that context and not create a romantic history around these things, because that's not reality. That's not reality.
That's it. Like, my mother told me a story when I was trying to find inspiration for this volume. Shout out to the volume that YOLO beautifully wrote the foreword to. And my mom was always like, she's always going to pull a story out of nowhere. Like, I've known you for how long? My whole life, and you never told me this story. She told me a story about an unhoused man who used to live in their hometown. My mom's from the country, right? Middle of Virginia, like a house every mile. And she said that this man, as far as they knew, right? They said he lived in the forest. That's how all the kids understood him. But every Sunday, they knew he would get hungry while everybody was at church. And so everybody would cook and put out food specifically for him so he could come around, get food while everybody was at church. I think about that level of familiarity with somebody that is unhoused, that amount of like love and care and like just the normalization of that. Like, no, we take care of this person. And I think about that in the context of where we're at right now. I think about New York City, where right now you think about unhoused people and people feel deeply unsafe. There's no recognition. There's no love. There's no, to our point, there's no skill sets for what care looks like. And so people have no other tools than, yo, get this person out of my face. Like, they talking to themselves, I don't want to be around this person. That doesn't make me feel safe. And some of these conversations, I was having this conversation with one of my students, you have to honor that. You know, if you don't teach people how to see the humanity of somebody else, it's going to be scary. Like, people have been hurt, people have been harmed, and that's the truth of it. But there are ways, and that's where we talk about like uplifting this. Oh, there's modes of relation that allow people to see their humanity, to show up and care, right?
There's also evidence to say that like safety has increasingly, and maybe not increasingly, but historically been seen as well, but increasingly seen as only synonymous with ableist presentation.
Exactly.
So like and so safety is about ableist, like, you know, one of our partners in Atlanta is PAD, Policing Alternative Division. Like, they essentially divert people away from prisons. Mm-hmm. And like particularly they also service 311, which is the emergency call number in Atlanta, and they'll have trained social workers and teammates come out there to support folks. And you know, I talk to them and we train them, we work with them, and like a lot of the things they'll tell me, they'd be like, we get calls where somebody's like, that person outside is talking to the tree. So I just, it was like, well, are they bothering you with the tree? No, they're not bothering me. The tree is like, they're like a mile away. I can see it, but they just been talking to the tree for a while. Okay, so where is the emergency per se, right? The lack of safety is rooted in this idea that like, if there's not a certain vision of ableism present, that like I'm in danger, as opposed to, am I in bodily danger? Is this person like, you know what I mean? They become synonymous in people's minds, right? And that's been a lot of like media. That's been a lot of like, you know, other experiences, but it makes me think about like, we kind of have this conversation around what safety looks like, you know what I mean? Challenge it around the ways in which neurodivergence shows up, right? Like, you know what I mean? Because the media's done a good job of making us believe those things are synonymous, right? Like, you know what I mean? And they're not, like, you know, I think, you know, my opinion.
You know? Yeah, I agree with like wholeheartedly. And the stories that people are told about people that they're supposed to be in community with, right? The idea of, you could immediately envision a world in which somebody walks through, like, oh yeah, that's so and so. They talk to trees. This is so and so, right? Mm-hmm. And just moving about their life because they understand, oh yeah, that person has to have a conversation with the tree sometime. Mm-hmm. We see that, we know that, we understand that, we recognize that. Mm-hmm. And we care about that. We care about that person. Yeah. Versus the rhetoric, again, we're in histories of being told if I see somebody on the street, that's a crackhead. And so not only is this person dangerous, they chose to do this. I've heard so many people talk about, like, there's this willful degree to which this person is currently in this state, right? And so now I'm meeting this uncertainty, not with love and care, but with animosity, with hatred, right?
And that thing that comes out of all the unprocessed grief, like we talked about this in my beam. I'm like, I don't feel like we've ever had a moment to really acknowledge, like, you know, when heroin and cocaine, like, when it hit our crack, when it hit our communities, there's this whole generation of us who, I know for myself, I grew up watching my uncle who my grandmother mother had to keep out the house because he would steal things, right? So he would was pushing a cart, you know, getting collecting cans. I was walking to school. I would see him every morning. He would speak to me, like, make sure I had something or whatever. But like, I grew up with that, and there was a grief, right? There was also like a judgment and a shame that a lot of us carried. It's his children, my cousin, all of us, right? And there's this whole generations of us having that experience, and you see it kind of coming through that anger that's like mad at him, mad at them, as opposed to like, no, my uncle got exposed to a substance, right? Okay. That created a physiological challenge for him that is incomparable if you never experienced it. And that, like, that, and it's compounded with being a Black man in America, navigating the trauma of class and race and all these things, like, converge on the lack of care, right? Like, you know what I mean? To create this scenario. And my family had no skills and tools to support him or to navigate him, right? But, like, there's real pain because it's like, hey, he stole the TV once.
Yeah.
Now, we're mad about that, right? Yeah. And then there's sometimes that people can't always understand that, like, the physiological shifts that happen when you're in that state people can't always make that understanding, right? So there's a lot of anger in our communities about the things that we've experienced from our folks who have been navigating relationships with these substances, right? And they've shown up in ways they've harmed us or created stress for us or, you know, all these things. But where have we had the space, Evan, to be able to name that and process it? When we first did our first workshop, Black Families and Schizophrenia, with Dr. Alan Lipscomb, who created it with us, the number of people who came through and the ways in which, just by naming the experiences, people were like, whoo, I've never been in a space where I could just even say this to somebody, particularly in a framework that invited us to have compassion centered and not shame and judgment. And so many of us are walking around with that, carrying that, you know, for a generation of our folks, you know?
That's it. No, the work that y'all do is beautiful. But this is it. Like, I'm thinking about this at the intersection of so many distinct modes of indoctrination, right? This idea of individualism leading people to hold all of their anger and hate in the body of another person, right? The anti-Blackness, right? That makes somebody's difficulties or distress looks like just savagery for people.
Right.
And a capitalist environment that doesn't give people the space to talk about this, to have to really see. Because this is the thing. This is the piece. The work that we're talking about, this is work of a lifetime, right? You're talking about moving through rupture and repair. You're talking about rupture and repair with ancestors. You're talking about deeply learning yourself. You're talking about hoping and visioning for the future. This is the work of a lifetime that we live in such economic precarity that people, like, I guarantee you, people gonna be listening to this. You won't have the people like snapping the whole time. Half the people like, I don't got time for all that.
Well, not say it, because I'm trying to survive. And that's about also what capitalism does, right? It creates the conditions where care are not possible because we're trying to sustain in insurmountable conditions. I gotta work 40 hours plus a week. I gotta like navigate the fact that I can barely afford childcare. I gotta navigate. I gotta cook. Like, you know what I mean? Like all these things. And then I'm like, I'm working doing that. I'm working so many hours. And then I'm also like not having the energy to create sustenance food that I want to eat. So the food that I'm eating is easily get access to cheap. Then it's creating all kinds of physiological problems for my body. There's like this, it's a cycle. And so like, you're absolutely right. Care. There's a way in which this capitalist system inhibits the possibilities of care. Like, you know, when we see it currently in what's happening, right? It's like, cut the care, cut needs for everybody, cut support for everybody. It's not good business sense, right? Keep people in a state of distress so they will need to go to work, right? And keep them just hungry enough.
Yeah.
You know, just barely fed. And that's the logic of systems that don't humanize people, or systems don't center care. And I think that, like, the opportunity that, like, you know, I think about you often, and, like, you know, we talk about the maroon communities, right? Like, you know what I mean? And I think about, I'm like, look, we need to create a maroon community where we just like, girl, we out. Y'all do what y'all need to do over there, but we don't build a home. And you see that happening. I feel like Black communities are like, we're buying land. We buying a whole town. Like, we just like, y'all figure that out. We can't be a part of that, no.
Yeah. No, that's it. I'm thinking about two things. One, I'm thinking about one of our friends, Marcus Board Jr. I was having a conversation with him. He's a brilliant political scientist over at Howard. And he was saying, because of what we're talking about, because of people's deep needs to sustain and survive, he's saying one of the pillars of people's politics have to be making movement also nourishing. Right. And then when we forget that, right. And it's difficult. It's so difficult because we're talking about active warfare, right? We're in the context where we're watching, right? I'm not too far away from where they snatched up the tough student, right? Walking through her community, snatched her right up, right? We're living in that type of environment right now where you've had organizers who've fought, bled, cried, right? A lot from the people that they want to be in community with and want to be in movement with. Right. And it's painful that so much of the structures get displaced onto one another. And so he talks about what are the strategies, what are the politics that we can do so people can come to these spaces. Because at the end of the day, we're talking about needing more people in these things over a lifetime. So what are the ways that we can shape our politics such that they're also nourishing to people who have to choose between taking an extra job to support a child and showing up to that meeting? Right. And shout out to all the people who are doing both, because there's a lot of people doing all of those pieces. Right. The other thing I want to add really quickly is, again, when you honor different lineages, you also add to the possibility. So to the point, I was just going through a documentary. I'm going to butcher the name. I apologize for that. I think it's Barbusha. I know for a fact I butchered that pronunciation, in Algeria. Right? I think it was right after the Arab Spring that it exists as its own commune and colony. I think about like 13,000 people who decided that we don't want to exist in that type of political system and framework. And so since then have been governing themselves. Right. I want to be very clear. People should do their own digging. I watched a documentary, did not update. So please go Google that to make sure that I'm not telling you a fiction, but there are political possibilities that we can look to shape our current conditions.
Ooh, said so many things. I know we have to wrap soon. Instead, we could talk for like hours. We have been like... Like, this podcast episode is 5 hours. What are we doing? I'm like, okay, we gotta cut it. Okay. But you know what, piece 7 that I feel like I have struggled with and that has been so central to the work that Beam does is that I saw really early on how so many movements for social justice, movement for a variety of different challenges we've been facing, didn't centralize care. Mm. And so for me with Beam, it was like, we got to make a movement that care is the currency, the care is the support. And so it's always so illuminating to me because everybody ain't there to see care as built to build a movement that centers care. They don't quite see it. There are times people come to me and be like, well, how are you doing movement building at Beam? I'm like, really? That's such a, how could I not? How could you look at anything we do and not see it? Oh, it's because it's not linear. You don't see a trajectory, like we're not leading to a policy advocacy thing, but you don't see the organizing around care, the intentional planting of tools and resources in communities, the intentional resourcing of I call the underground network of, like, you know, grassroots wellness organizations. You don't see that as movement building because you don't see care as movement building. You see care in the way the white world has taught you to see care, which is something that is separate from movement. But everything that I've learned, you know, I had the privilege of going to school for Africana studies. And I remember looking at the Black Panther Party and being like, nobody told me these niggas was building care systems. Nobody told me that. Nobody told me those pieces. Nobody told me how revolutionary those. And now people are talking about that more in public and mainstream spaces. But for me, it was like, clearly, we got to take care of people. And that's how you build movement. That's how you build care. That's how you build education and tools. And people have more resources when they are supported, whether it's monthly groups, whether it's Black Masculinity Reimagined, whether it's getting cash into people's hands, when they know people come to us and they're like, we see that you care because you really show up. And that's when, and guess what? You show up for the people who show up, you care. And so, like, we're always shocked. You know, one thing we've been really kind of looking at is like, whoa, something's happened the last couple of years. So where all of our donor numbers have gone up, where we get like $10, $15 a month from people, like, why is it going up so much? Oh, it's going up because people are like, you care for me.
Yeah.
I want to care for you. I see you caring for other people. And I think that, like, you know, not to critique other movements, but I've seen many movements where care was not the centralizing, organizing force. And that is why they, a big part of why they fell apart. There was no one examining the emotional texture of what's happening and the regulation practices of what people. It was a lot of theory for it, but not the practice. And so what I've been like, we got to center that and bring in the nuances of those pieces for care to really bring us together, you know?
That's it. That's it. I was thinking as you were speaking that, again, for people to be intentional about the legacies that they're honoring. We're talking about, again, Mutulu Shakur. We're talking about free acupuncture clinics. Right, in New York. That's a legacy, right?
Wow.
I'm big on Bobby Wright. I love Bobby Wright. That's a Black psychologist in Chicago who was one of the people who educated Fred Hampton in the Chicago area Black Panthers with this Communiversity, was also giving specifically community clinics dedicated towards Black mental health needs, right? So for a lot of these movements, it's the stories that we don't tell, right?
Come on.
Intentional about these practices of care that we can live up to. Like, that's the other piece that might be one of my pet peeves is in some of these spaces, people talk about we have to create something completely brand new. And I'm like, in that, we're erasing some of these legacies. We're erasing some of these tools.
Yes.
And again, these aren't panaceas, but we can't act like we aren't coming from people who've thought deeply about how to do this. We have those tools that we can't to shout out y'all to remix for this particular political moment.
Yeah. And that's the word. Evan, I could talk to you all day. I want to acknowledge that we are definitely going over a little bit more. There's so much to say, and I just have so much reverence and respect and honor for you. Not in a way that makes you, puts you on a pedestal that dehumanizes you. I know you are navigating things, you know, like we all are. But I want to say that I see the beauty in you, even as you are navigating those things. And I appreciate that you exist and that you inspire me and you teach me. And there's so much more, I think, that is just powerful and beautiful in the world because you have chosen to move more into your light, into your wisdom. So thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing.
I'm about to say real quick, this is what we say ABCI, right? With the circles, and this is what the Zulu say, right? Sawubona, right? So I see you. Right? That the ancestors, the collective of me sees you. And it feels good to be seen by you. So it's been an honor to, it's always an honor to share space with you.
Evan, can you tell people where they can find you and some of the places you work with? Because you do a lot of different multidisciplinary work. Can you tell people?
I'm the current chair for the Association of Black Psychologists Sawubona Healing Circle Program. I'm the lead for Healing Justice with Haiti at Inculture Company. And right now I'm with the board for the Institute for the Development of Human Arts. So a few things where we try to make sure our work is directly responsive to the needs of the people.
Thank you for your work. How can we find you on socials? If you're sharing, you want to share on socials, how to find you?
Dr.Evan.August, A-U-G-U-S-T-E, August.
Awesome. Thank you so much again. This has been Black Healing Remix with Dr. Evan August. Y'all know y'all got to find him, follow up, lots of good stuff, and more healing coming your way. Thank y'all.
Thank you.
Now, those are the kind of dialogues that I love having. Dialogues that take us deeper into the conversation, beyond the surface level, beyond woo-woo wellness, but actually grasping at the root.
I want to thank Dr. Evan Agus once again for joining us for this conversation. And if you are looking to continue to dive deeper, make sure you visit our website at beam.community, where you can find resources, tools, and much, much more. And also, make sure you take a moment to rate us as well. Thank you so much for joining us. And this has been Black Healing Remixed.